This brings us to the fourth and final case on our calendar for oral argument, and I think we're going to see some of the same people. It's the Minnesota Alliance for Retired Americans Educational Fund versus Steve Simon. While you are getting settled, I'll tell you what you probably don't need to have a reminder of, but I will anyway, and that is that our procedures give each side 15 minutes for their argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have, or I guess appellants, plural, you will have, or appellant singular, respondents, plural, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument. And you know how the podium works? So when you are ready, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Alan Cook Barr. I'm an assistant attorney general, and I represent appellant Minnesota Secretary of State Steve Simon. Minnesota consistently has one of the highest voter turnout rates in the country. This is in part because of how easy it is to vote absentee in Minnesota. But to ensure that polling place safeguards remain present when someone votes absentee, Minnesota has required an absentee voting witness since it implemented absentee voting over 150 years ago. In the polling place, election judges ensure that the same person who certifies their own eligibility is the person who receives a ballot, that that ballot is blank when it is given to the person, that the person marks it without the influence of anyone else, and that the ballot is put in the ballot box without tampering. The certifications made by absentee witnesses that ensure that those same safeguards are present when someone votes without an election judge present. But according to respondents in the district court, for the last 60 years, and unbeknownst to anyone, these safeguards have violated federal law. This court should reverse. We've briefed multiple bases for reversal, but I'd like to focus today on the issue of first impression in Minnesota, the interpretation of the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. Under the Voting Rights Act, states are prohibited from requiring as a prerequisite for voting that someone prove his qualifications by the voucher of registered voters or members of any other class. Thus, to violate the Voting Rights Act, a state requirement must require a voucher to prove qualifications. None of the witness certifications for do so, either for registered voters or for unregistered voters.
But with respect to unregistered voters, the argument is that not only are you certifying that, yes, I saw the voter take the ballot, mark the ballot, put it back in the envelope, those certifications that are required for all voters, but that the witness must attest to the fact that the heretofore unregistered voter took another step, and that is provided proof of residency, which is one of the qualifications to vote. Isn't that different material in a material way from the certifications or attestations that one does with respect to registered voters?
It is an additional step, but I would push back, Your Honor, on providing proof as being a qualification. The qualification is that you, in fact, are old enough, that you live in the precinct, that you have not had your voting rights denied, things of that nature. Providing the document is not itself a qualification. And moreover, the witness is not certifying that the document is accurate, that it is valid. All they are certifying is that the document was shown. That is not a voucher of qualifications.
And what's the definition of voucher that we would rely on? I understand that's not defined in the Act.
It is not defined in the Act, Your Honor. I think you can use the definitions that we identify in our brief, that someone attests to something, or I think that even under the definition that respondents provide, substantiate with evidence, that still doesn't make that a voucher because the certification of the individual is not itself substantiating that the qualifications met. All it's doing is showing that the individual presented a document and the individual saw that document. It does not establish that the qualifications are met. That is done on the back end when the voter registration document is reviewed by the county auditor and they take steps to either then say, yes, this person goes on the voter rolls, or if the person doesn't, it turns out, doesn't meet the qualifications for voting, change that voter's status in the statewide voter registration system to not being an active voter. As the court noted, the certifications for registered voters likewise are not, or I guess for all voters, both registered and unregistered, those are only certifications of voter conduct.
Are those issues before us?
I don't think they are, Your Honor. No, the respondents did not appeal that portion of the district court's order. Of course, they're part of the certifications for unregistered voters, but I don't think they're properly before the court, no. With respect to the Civil Rights Act, the district court held that that was violated with respect to already registered voters. That was incorrect because the Voting Rights Act does not apply to ballot envelopes used by registered voters. It applies only to records and papers that are used to make a voter qualified. We know that based on the plain language of the statute, which says that it relates to denying the right to vote of any individual because of an error or omission on any record or paper relating to any application, registration, or other act requisite to voting, if such error or omission is not material in determining whether such individual is qualified to vote. That tells us that what the paper...
I hung up on what does act requisite to voting mean? You're saying that it is akin to registration application.
Yes, Your Honor.
Why should we conclude that?
Based on three things just on the plain language of the statute, and then if not plain language, the host of other tools. Starting with the plain language, the other act requisite voting is informed by the things that precede it: registration, application. Additionally, the following clause says if such error is material, error or omission is not material in determining. That determining suggests that that's the activity that has to be going on with the paper. It's not that the determination has already been made. It's that the paper is being used in determining whether or not someone is qualified to vote. Third, the remedies identified within the Civil Rights Act for violations of the statute are that the U.S. Attorney General can bring an action to bring the individual into compliance. And if they do so, the remedy is declaring the person qualified to vote. That suggests that once someone is qualified and that qualification determination has been made, there is nothing left for the materiality provision to do. Additionally, actually four reasons now that I think of it, under the plain language, the terms surrounding the provision in which the materiality provision applies are both directed entirely towards voter qualification. Courts don't read statutes in isolation when determining plain language, and those surrounding provisions indicate the materiality provision is directed at similar such harms.
So, counsel, just to make sure I understand, the statutory interpretation analysis and the Pennsylvania State Conference of NAACP, do you basically agree with that statutory analysis? That's what I
agree. Absolutely, Your Honor, yes. And that brings me to my next point, actually, which is courts around the country that have looked at this, the weight of the authority agrees. The materiality provision is directed towards documents that are voter qualification determining documents, not documents used in the actual mechanics of voting. Pennsylvania NAACP says that. The Liebert case out of Wisconsin, very similar case to this case, says that, as do other federal district courts around the country. The only contrary authority that opposing counsel has identified are three cases out of the Northern District of Georgia, which I will note, the Common Cause District Court case out of the Northern District of Georgia went the other way, and then one case out of Texas, a Texas federal court, that decision is not final yet, and it's still, I believe, on appeal, is my recollection. So the weight of authority supports that is the meaning of the materiality provision. But even if the court thinks that other act language is ambiguous, the tools for resolving that ambiguity clearly indicate it was not intended to apply to things that are used for voting mechanics after qualifications have been determined. Throughout the legislative history, when they were discussing the materiality provision, uniformly the focus was on voter registration, and how people had been denied the right to register to vote due to discriminatory practices. There was no discussion that after someone was registered to vote, that the materiality provision would apply. And that's for good reason, because it would lead to absurd results.
I'm going to ask some questions now that go to the question of standing, which
sure.
receives prominent attention in the briefing. I think it was the first thing in the reply brief that you pointed to in terms of a ground for reversal. Help me understand how the issue of standing was presented in the district court, because I see the briefing here makes this big distinction between registered voters and unregistered voters that I don't see the district court breaking down the standing of the three plaintiffs in that way. Can you help me understand how it was presented and how we would approach the issue of standing if the distinction that is drawn now between registered and unregistered voters wasn't made in the district court?
Your Honor, my recollection is that it was made in the district court, perhaps not with as fine-grained analysis as we're raising it here. I will also note initially that standing is an issue that can be raised at any time. It can't be waived.
I understand that. I'm just trying to understand how the arguments were made.
Sure. And with respect...
And whether there's a record that needs to be developed or something like that.
I don't think there is a record that needs to be developed, Your Honor. We raised in our briefing in the district court that none of the plaintiffs had standing, and we pointed out to the district court in our initial brief that that respondents did not allege any unregistered voter as a member of the alliance, and that neither Maples nor Mohammed were unregistered voters.
Even if that's, I mean, I guess I have a couple of questions. Is it reasonable to conclude that at least one of the 84,282 members of the alliance could be unregistered?
I'm not going to stand up here and claim it's an impossibility. But
well, and secondly, I'm wondering if you know the interest being advanced here, the interest in finding this statute violates the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. Do they? I mean, isn't that interest shared whether, I mean, it's the witness requirement fully that's being challenged, not just as to the certification required for an unregistered voter, but for all registration. Why isn't that enough to provide standing to at least the alliance?
I want to briefly comment on the lack of a member. While it might be possible that they have an unregistered member, they need to plead facts establishing that claim. You start from the proposition that a party doesn't have standing and they have to plead standing. That means they needed to plead a fact establishing that they were going to be injured with respect to unregistered voters. As to the second part of your...
Do you? I mean, that then I get to, the second and the more thorny question for me is, you know, to have standing, which we liberally, you know, construe under Minnesota law, isn't it enough to say we are harmed by the witness requirement and then let the different arguments as to why we are harmed, you know, be made in the course of the litigation?
I think a party has to at least identify in some way how they are harmed and can't just say carte blanche, I'm harmed without any explanation. Otherwise, all a party would have to do to avoid a Rule 12 motion would be in every case plead, I'm harmed, period, and they would have standing. And that is certainly not what Minnesota courts have held. They have required something beyond just an abstract harm.
To the extent the alliance says we have, and we know we have two, because with the two individual plaintiffs are members of the alliance and are registered voters. So to the extent the alliance as an entity has members that would fall into that court category, and given, you know, the case law, Ruckovina in particular, that suggests to me that the alliance would have standing in and of itself. Once that occurs, again, why wouldn't that standing be sufficient to present the entirety of the challenges to the witness requirement before the district court, before this court?
Because to challenge a law, you have to be negatively impacted by that law. And so while the witness requirement as a whole is in statute, that it and rule, that rule then has subparts, and each there's I believe it's on page 11 or so, there's a picture of the envelope, and it lays out various bullet points of what the witness has to do. each of those bullet points has to work a harm, because otherwise people would be able to challenge entireties of laws even if they aren't harmed by a particularity of a subsection. And the problem that both the alliance and the individual respondents have is that the harms they're alleging are shared by every other Minnesotan that votes absentee. There's nothing unique to them that would give them standing distinct from a generalized grievance shared by the entirety of the public.
I was just going to come back to that, but then doesn't that bring us back to the Rukavina case? So that when we're evaluating it, we just say, look, is there anyone better? This impacts a lot of people. Is there any entity better suited to bring this lawsuit?
I can, hypothetically, I could think of if someone were actually denied the right to vote, or there were, they could point to specific circumstances about them that actually created an imminent danger that they would lose the right to vote. That would be the better party. But it's not enough to be burdened by the law, because every law imposes a burden, yet we don't say that every law can be challenged by any person, even if there's a slight burden.
Thank you. Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Counsel for respondents.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Uzoma Nkwanta from Elias Law Group on behalf of plaintiffs Minnesota Alliance for Retired Americans Educational Fund, Teresa Maples, and Mr. Khalid Muhammad. Your Honor, Minnesota's witness requirement, as opposing counsel has just acknowledged, accomplishes next to nothing. It does not identify the voter. It does not confirm the voter's qualifications. It reveals nothing about the voter's age, residence, or citizenship. Yet a sworn statement is still required to establish eligibility and vote. The district court correctly denied the secretary's motion to dismiss, and the allegations in the amended complaint clearly stake out a claim for a violation of both the Voting Rights Act and the Civil Rights Act. I'd like to start by addressing some of the arguments made with respect to the Civil Rights Act and the materiality provision in particular. Opposing counsel's reading of the materiality provision and interpretation.
Can I, just to clarify, the district court, I think the only issue before us is the Civil Rights Act as it applies to registered voters, correct?
I would push back on that, Your Honor. The secretary has appealed the district court's denial of the motions to dismiss with respect to registered voters and unregistered voters. So the secretary is arguing that the district court should have granted the motions to dismiss with respect to both categories of voters.
But, okay, and you, the district court, I believe, granted the dismissal motion with respect to, am I wrong about
that? District court did not grant, the district court denied all the dismissal motions.
But in the memorandum, you would agree that the district court at least made some findings, because I believe there's a paragraph in which the district court talks about how the Civil Rights Act is not violated as it relates to unregistered voters.
So that is correct.
And if so, how do we address that finding as a contrary finding to, in essence, saying this claim's going to move forward, but as it relates to unregistered voters, Civil Rights Act doesn't apply?
So that's absolutely correct, Judge Harris. The district court did say that in its opinion. However, what the court is reviewing here is the district court's order. And the district court's observations are not appealable. It's the order that's appealable. The district court's order denied the motions to dismiss. And that is why plaintiffs did not appeal the district court's order.
Well, that gets to the other issue under the Voting Rights Act. I think the district court also said, in a sense, granted dismissal with respect to registered voters.
But the district court did not grant dismissal. The district court denied the motion to dismiss. And again, because the district court denied the motion to dismiss, there is no order for plaintiffs to appeal. However, to the extent the secretary believes that the district court should have granted that motion to dismiss, plaintiffs are not precluded from raising any arguments under the law that they would be entitled to refute that notion and to uphold the district court's order. Unless there are any further questions on this topic, I want to jump to the arguments that opposing counsel raised with respect to the Civil Rights Act and the interpretation of the materiality provision. The opposing counsel has advanced several theories of how the materiality provision should be applied that are untethered from its text. There are two clauses in the materiality provision. There's the primary clause, which establishes that no person should deny the right of an individual to vote because of an error or omission on a record or paper relating to any application, registration, or any other act requisite to voting. Then the secondary clause defines the errors or omissions that the prohibition applies to. The prohibition applies to errors or omissions that are not material in determining whether such individual is qualified to vote under state law. The restriction of this provision, the limitation of this provision to registration, is nowhere to be found in the text of the statute. And that is why the Secretary's argument is so untethered to its text.
Yeah, but application registration goes to is someone eligible to vote, right? You have to meet the requirements of registration. Isn't that synonymous with being qualified?
Not necessarily, because there's a reason why Congress chose those separate terms. Congress could have just said registration, but there are separate terms there: registration, application, and other acts requisite to voting. And to treat all of those as synonymous with registration would actually subvert Congress's intent. Second, the application, that term application itself, can apply to things that occur after registration. It can occur to applications to request an absentee ballot, applications to vote absentee. There are some states that define absentee ballot envelopes as applications. In other words, the term application does not have some unitary meaning that is always synonymous with registration.
But what does qualification mean?
Individual
is qualified under state law to vote. What does qualification mean?
Qualified refers to the substantive qualifications of voting in the state. So that includes here age, residency, and citizenship, not being adjudged mentally incapacitated, et cetera. Those are the types of qualifications that pretty much all courts to interpret the materiality provision have acknowledged are qualifications, substantive qualifications to vote. Now, the exemption that opposing counsel tries to carve out, or the argument that he tries to make, is that this provision only applies to registration. Well, that would subvert the intent of Congress, and that would make the statute virtually meaningless because states could create whatever procedure, whatever process that they wanted to deny individuals a right to vote based on immaterial paperwork errors. They just have to call it something other than registration. And we should not assume that Congress endeavored to pass an effective statute. And I want to point out that when opposing counsel said that the weight of the case law supports his interpretation, that was absolutely incorrect. It's actually the exact opposite. The weight of the case law rejects the interpretation the Secretary advances here, and I can go through each case one by one. The only two cases that the Secretary has cited that accept that interpretation are the Third Circuit's ruling in PA-NAACP and the Western District of Wisconsin's ruling in Liebert, which just followed PA-NAACP's analysis. And I believe there's one other case in the District of Florida that may have mentioned or adopted that same reasoning. So I don't want to say there are only two. But the vast majority of the cases reject that interpretation. And that includes vote.org, the Georgia State Board of Elections, Martin v. Crittenden, In re Georgia Senate Bill, SB 202, La Union del Pueblo Entero v. Abbott from the Western District of Texas, Migliori v. Cohen, the same Third Circuit that issued the PNAACP opinion, rejected the interpretation the Secretary advanced here. It's just that decision was vacated as moot by the Supreme Court. That was a Munsingware vacater. But no one has sort of, no court has reversed that ruling. A different panel of the Third Circuit issued a contrary ruling. So the Third Circuit has actually spoken and has been of different minds about this interpretation. And then League of Women Voters of Arkansas v. Thurston, another court that rejects that interpretation. Ford v. Tennessee Senate, another court that rejects that interpretation. And going back to Liebert, the Liebert court, that very same court, the very same judge issued an opinion 2 years earlier in which said that the plain language of the materiality provision is not limited to registration. It's not limited to in the way that the secretary argues. But even if this court were to interpret the materiality provision in a way that limits its operation to voter qualification documents, which is what the PA and NAACP court in Liebert said, the witness requirement would still fall within the scope of the materiality provision because that witness statement and a certificate of eligibility are actually used to determine a voter's eligibility under Minnesota law. In other words, if you're looking at what the purpose is of the witness requirement or the witness statement, it differs from the purposes of the witness requirement in Wisconsin, where all the parties in Wisconsin agreed that the witness requirement was not, or the witness statement was not part of the voter qualification process. And in PA and NAACP, all the parties agreed that the date on an absentee ballot envelope was not part of the voter qualification process. But Minnesota law actually makes the witness statement part of the qualification process. And the reason is Section 203B7, Subdivision 121, hope I got that correct. But that provision specifically instructs the ballot board to review the certificate of eligibility, including the witness statement, to determine whether the voter is eligible.
And so the board is determining the voter's eligible, not the witness.
Yeah, so the board is determining whether the voter's eligible. The board is not using any information from the witness statement to make that determination, but the board is still making that determination using that certificate of eligibility, using that envelope. So the reason why the distinction the secretary draws here is still not controlling is because we're still in the voter qualification process. We're still in the process of determining eligibility. That process did not end with registration in North Carolina, under Minnesota law, like it may under Wisconsin law, like it may under North Carolina law. Minnesota law is different. That determination continues into the absentee voting process.
So you've been talking a lot about the non-registered or the unregistered voter in terms of your arguments. I'd like you to talk about standing because that is, of course, a threshold issue. And looking at the record, looking at the amended complaint, there doesn't seem to be any allegations that any of the plaintiffs are unregistered voters. So how would they have standing to assert the interest of an unregistered voter?
Well, the secretary's argument ignores the alliance's organizational standing. The alliance has asserted associational standing and organizational standing.
But there's no allegation that your association includes members who are unregistered voters.
Well, there's no specific allegation to that effect. That is correct, Your Honor. That is not necessarily controlling here because, again, there are two facets of the alliance's standing. There's associational standing and organizational standing based on the diversion of resources. The fact that there hasn't been an identified member who's unregistered does not impact the standing based on the diversion of resources. Now, what causes the diversion of resources is the witness requirement. The witness requirement forces the alliance to divert resources in order to connect its membership, it's 82,000 members, to connect them with witnesses. And in doing that, in making that diversion, it would be nonsensical to try to distinguish between unregistered and registered voters. That diversion occurs in response to the witness requirement, regardless of whatever nuance in the law may impact different voters. The alliance is still connecting voters to witnesses, whether registered or unregistered, first. Second, going back to the point about the alliance's members and associational standing, the alliance has alleged that it has over 82,000 members in the state, and it would be absurd to assume that not one of those 82,000 members are either one, unregistered and have to register again, or two, have not moved, because when a voter moves to a different county, they also have to re-register. So those two assumptions would be unreasonable to make for an organization with for an organization of retirees with over 82,000 members in the state.
I guess, counsel, when I think about standing, one of the things that just keeps occurring to me, though, is, you know, these witness requirements have been basically the same, right, since 1949? In other words, they're longstanding. Is that fair to say?
Yes, with one caveat. The witness requirement was suspended in 2020. So 2024 election, the election that directly followed the Alliance's motion for temporary injunction, was the first general, was the first presidential election after 2020 in which the witness requirement was in force.
Okay.
So the argument that the Secretary makes about how this has been ongoing for 60 years doesn't take into account the fact that the witness requirement was effectively reinstated. And I also want to go back to a point
You have only a few seconds here. Can you address, again, as we look at the Voter Rights Act, what does it mean to vouch in terms of vouching? What's your definition of that?
I think the definition that has been advanced in the briefs are largely correct, basically to swear to a test based on one's knowledge. I think those definitions are fairly applicable here. The plain language of the statute, though, makes clear that the statute is not concerned with the content of the voucher, rather the fact that the voucher is used in proving qualifications. And for both registered and unregistered voters, that is what is occurring here. There is a voucher that is being used and being submitted to the ballot board, and then the ballot board is determining eligibility. But the ballot board is not considering the witness statement at all because it says nothing relevant. I see that my time is up. Unless anyone has any further questions, I will conclude my argument.
I see none. Thank you, counsel. Thank you. Mr. Barr, you will have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by pushing back against the idea that opposing counsel presented that the witness requirement doesn't accomplish anything. It accomplishes an important goal of ensuring that the person who vouched for their own eligibility is the same person that marked the ballot, that ballot wasn't interfered with before it was marked, and that it wasn't interfered after it was marked. Those goals would be frustrated if the district courts enjoined the witness requirement. Second, with respect to whether the issue was that the district court decided adversely or properly before this court, I would encourage the court to look at the case law regarding notices of related appeal, specifically Arndt v. American Family Insurance, 394 Northwest 2D 791. That case makes clear that the lack of appealability or that a judgment was entirely in a party's favor are not excuses for failing to file a notice of related appeal. If opposing counsel wanted to present the issues that the district court decided adversely, they should have filed a notice of related appeal after this court granted discretionary review. Third, we know what Congress intended to address with the materiality provision because we have the legislative history. That history confirms the materiality provision's scope is limited to registrations, applications, and similar procedures. It doesn't make the other acts superfluous. Rather, what that accomplishes is it ensures that states can't try and circumvent the Civil Rights Act by renaming a registration or an application as something else. Fourth, the Secretary contends that the materiality provision does not apply to registered voters, but if the court agrees with opposing counsel and concludes it does apply, that's not the end of the court's analysis. Then it has to decide whether or not what the witness certifies is material. And case law uniformly indicates that materiality is interpreted broadly, and that broad interpretation encompasses what the witness is doing. The witness is ensuring that the same person who certified their eligibility is the one who actually cast the ballot in that envelope. That is material to whether or not a qualified voter cast the ballot. Finally, with respect to standing, while it is certainly possible that the alliance had unregistered members. It was their obligation to plead that fact. They are the masters of their complaint. And if they wanted to pursue claims on unregistered members, all they had to do was send out an email to their membership and say, hey, are any of you unregistered? And then if someone had said yes, they could have pleaded that fact. They chose not to, even after the secretary pointed out that flaw in their initial, in the secretary's initial motion to dismiss. For all of those reasons, the court should reverse the district court. Unless the court has any questions, I yield the rest of my time.
I'm seeing none. Thank you. Thank you all both for your helpful arguments today. It's an important and interesting case, and we appreciate the time and attention you've devoted to it. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our opinion within the statutory 90-day period. That being our last case on the calendar for oral argument, we will be in recess.